This is a podcast about Jeopardy.
Hello and welcome to Potent Potables, your weekly Jeopardy podcast, where two former competitors bring you recaps and analysis of the week's Jeopardy episodes, a deep dive into a topic inspired by one of those episodes, and a quiz. I'm Emily.
And I'm Kyle, and this is the week of March 25th, 2024. We are knee-deep in the quarterfinals of the Jeopardy Invitational Tournament. And before we get to those very fun games, let's check in with each other. Emily, how's it going?
I have a new puppy in my house. It's great.
So everything
he's
is awesome.
So cute. His name is Loaf, and he's an 8-week-old, maybe 9 weeks now, corgi puppy, and he is adorable. The dog that we already had is adjusting reasonably well. She wants a lot of assurance that she's still loved. My daughter is doing great. She's the one who really lobbied to have a second dog, and she's not only doing a great job taking care of Loaf, but she's also like backseat driving the rest of the family to make sure that people give Zora, our first dog, lots of love and attention because she wants to make sure that their relationship is good, like the two dogs get along, which, you know, making sure that they don't feel like they're competing for the human's affection is super important. So yeah, things are great. Also, it's Holy Week. That's going fine. When we put a deposit down on a corgi puppy, we didn't know. It was before the litter was conceived. So I never imagined that we would be bringing the puppy home on This Is Good Friday when we're recording. It's going to be a little hectic this weekend, but it's okay. Everything's good. All good things. How about you?
Good. We do not have a new puppy, which I am just as excited about that as you are about having one. We are at our emotional capacity for creatures that rely on us. When I say
us, I mean
me and my wife. So, but things are good. Things are good. We're just kind of cruising along. It's not really news, but recently my older daughter for a while was telling me that, "Dad, you're the funniest person I know." And I was like, "Aw, I agree, but thank you for saying that." And then recently she informed me, "Dad, I don't think you're the funniest person I know anymore." And I was like, "That's okay. That's okay.
You,
I get that.
Are you embarrassing now?"
Oh, I mean, that's probably part of it. But I was like, "That's okay. It was a lot of pressure, you know, to try to maintain that. So I actually kind of appreciate that." And she was like, "Yeah, you're down to like number 10 now." And I was like, no, hold on. Now, down to like 2, maybe 3, I get like that's natural, like, you know, fluctuation in, you know, people's performance.
But like 9 people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, then who is number one now? And she was like, "Jose." And I'm like, "Well, who's Jose?" Because she has not mentioned this kid. And she's like, "He was in my class last year." And I'm like, okay, so someone you don't even see anymore has not only taken my top at the spot, but somehow done it so effectively that I have tumbled to double digits. All right. So long story short, I'm trying to find a first grader so I can, I don't know, establish my dominance over him or whatever and retake my spot. So that's going on in my world.
That's great.
Also, I was doing car repair yesterday. Everything just has to be so much harder whenever I'm working on anything. All I'm trying to do is replace the pads on my like front brakes. Should be simple. Realistically, shouldn't take more than 30 minutes. You pop the lug nuts off. You loosen the caliper. You take out the old pads. You put in the new pads. And there you go. Then you put it all back together. You're done. And then you do it on the other tire. But of course, everything has to be ridiculous, and my car is old. So, like, 2 of the wheel studs that hold the wheel on break off instead of loosening the lug nuts. So now I have to go and buy new ones and replace the wheel studs before I can even drive the car again.
Oh, anyway, no.
It's fine. It's a repair that is doable. I just...
Are we supposed to be replacing our own brake pads? Like, that is so far into the realm of, I will bring it to the nice man.
No, that's fine. People, like, you can pay for that. That's fine. Of all the car repairs, it is one of the simpler ones. And so if you're confident to do it yourself, you will save a good amount of money by just doing it yourself. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's my recent frustration.
Yeah, that does sound frustrating.
Anyway, we have Jeopardy to talk about. We don't need to talk about car repair. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, my daughter wants me to say on the podcast that she says hello to you, Kyle, and to the podcast listeners.
Hello, Emily's daughter, whose name I'm not going to say on a public forum.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hope you are doing well and enjoying your new puppy. Mm-hmm. Corgis are the best. All right, so we got some Jeopardy. We had some exciting games and contestants come back because, like, oh man, it is fun to see some of the people that we haven't seen in a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Anyway, Monday, we have the contestants Amy Schneider, a writer from Oakland, California, who I don't quite remember who exactly what she you know, who she is. We have Austin Rogers, a bar owner and author from New York, New York.
I should go to his bar sometime. I never have.
You probably should. Yeah. It would be harder for me to get there, but.
Mm-hmm.
And Celeste DiNucci, an arts strategist from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Celeste, it's been a while, I believe. She was on about 10 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm. She was in the Battle of the Decades and I think was the first woman to win a Tournament of Champions. Am I remembering that right?
I think that's right. Yeah. That sounds right. So, yeah, some pretty big names here. And the Jeopardy round categories are thinking about the Holy Roman Empire, the theater, let's get a drink, so nice we need the answer twice, name that tune, and words read backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Ken missed no opportunity to remind the audience that Austin owns a bar and there's a drink category on the board.
Mm-hmm.
After like the fourth or fifth reminder, I was like, okay, Ken. I think we all get it.
Yeah.
Austin also knows other things.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a prediction going into this game?
Oh, yeah. Amy, for sure. Yep. Mm-hmm. Amy was definitely my prediction. Like, Austin obviously, like, knows stuff. He was a tournament finalist and in the All-Stars. Celeste, again, if I haven't seen them in a while, if I'm like, I don't really remember who that is, I have no way of gauging because it's like, you know, what are they bringing to the table? Has their game stayed strong? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it has, but also maybe it hasn't. Who knows? But yeah, Amy was definitely my pick. How about you?
You know, I was thinking maybe Amy, but I also was aware that Austin had been doing professional trivia stuff, I think, more than I was aware of Amy. Like, Amy's been writing a book. She's been doing a speaking tour. I wondered whether Austin's trivia company work might be keeping him kind of sharper. But I was not totally sure between Austin and Amy.
Sure. I think that's a reasonable consideration.
Mm-hmm.
We did have a tough miss and rebound in the So Nice We Need the Answer Twice category, $400 level. Jimi Hendrix Voodoo Child, slight return, opens with riffs using this pedal. Austin got in and said, what's a wah? That's incorrect, because it's a wah-wah, because you need to say it twice. Celeste got it.
Yeah, solid game from everyone here. Very few triple stumpers, just a couple of them in the theater category. I couldn't remember what musical has The Winner Takes It All. That's an ABBA song, so it's Mamma Mia. Celeste tried What Is a Chorus Line, and then it turned into a triple stumper. And they also couldn't figure out which London park has the open air theater. Amy tried What Is Hyde Park, but it's in Regent's Park. Daily double number one is in Let's Get a Drink. It's at the $1,000 level. Austin finds it at pick number 12. He's at 1,600. Celeste is at 600. Amy is at 2,800. Austin makes it a true daily double, and he gets the clue. One origin story of this cocktail involves the early morning hours after a long night in Sausalito. And he guesses and gets it correct with What Is a Tequila Sunrise. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Celeste is at 2,400, Austin's at 5,600, Amy's at 7,600, and the Double Jeopardy categories are Panhandle States, The Grammys Great Moments, Marine Biology, I Am a Poet, that's I Am, like the poetic, like foot, Five Guys, and Say It in Latin. Solid Latin knowledge from Amy. She got four out of those five. Austin got the $400 level. You know, In Good Faith or The Real Deal, like a rock star. With an S at the end, it means your credentials. And that's bona fides or bona fides. Bona fide. I think they would have taken with or without the S and Americanized or Latin pronunciation.
Probably. I don't know. It says say it in Latin.
Say it in Latin.
Would they have taken the Americanized pronunciation? Makes me think of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
He's bona fide. Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually in my life learned what QED was actually short for. So $2,000 level QED is short for this, meaning which was to be demonstrated. Quod erat demonstrandum?
Yeah, I think I would have guessed it was demonstratum, and had I had that clue, I think I would have lost money. But Amy knew it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had a real big swing at the bottom of the poet category, $2,000 level. I did write The Lay of the Last Minstrel and many other bonny iambic work, and you needn't call me sir. Austin rang in and had no response. Celeste rang in and said, who is Burns? I guess taking the clue of being Scottish. But Amy got in with who is Scott. Sir Walter Scott.
Yeah. I felt for Amy, although she managed to pull it out. At the $1,600 level of marine biology, this member of the weasel family is the only marine mammal that catches fish with its forepaws, not its mouth. And she said, what's an otter? And had to be more specific. It's a sea otter, not a river otter. Or I guess there are other kinds of otter also.
Yeah, just no. Fair.
Like the level of specificity with which you're supposed to know otters surprised me.
Can you be more specific? I don't know. Steve? Daily Double number 2 is in Panhandle States at the $1,600 level. It's pick number 4. Amy finds it. She is at 10,800. Celeste at 1,200. Austin is at 5,600. And she wagers 6,000 and gets the clue. West Virginia's northern panhandle is bordered on the north and west by this river. And she gets correct with what is the Ohio?
Mm-hmm. And Daily Double number 3 is at the $1,200 level of marine biology. Amy finds this one also. She's at 27,600 at this point, with Austin at 5,200. Celeste is at negative 2,400. Amy wagers just 1,000 this time. And her clue is the heaviest bony fish at a weight of more than 6,050 pounds. It has a celestial name and dines mainly on jellyfish. She doesn't know. She tries what is an angelfish, but this is a sunfish.
Mm, giant.
Yeah.
Weird looking
fish. They are
fish.
So weird.
They're off-putting. They upset me. Yes. Their faces upset me. I'm like, same. Oh. Yeah. So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Celeste is in it at 800. Austin is at 9,600, but Amy has a lock at 28,600. Final Jeopardy category is Notorious Figures, and the clue, never even a soldier, this man lied that his nickname came from a shrapnel wound while fighting in the Argonne. This was a triple stumper, kind of surprised about. I guess you could go in a lot of different directions, but Celeste wrote, who is Bullet? That's incorrect. And she wagered everything, dropped to 0. Austin wrote, what is How Can I Beat Amy? And Shots on Me. And wagered 1,696. And Amy wrote, who is Colonel Parker? That's also incorrect. And she wagered nothing, of course. The correct answer is Al Capone, who's known as Scarface.
I did not figure it out, so
I tried to think of what sort of nicknames of anybody have injuries or scars in it. And I thought of Scarface and I was like, well, it seems like that's probably it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we'll see Amy back at the semifinals. Mm-hmm. And on Tuesday, we have the contestants David Madden, an academic competition director from Ridgewood, New Jersey, Arthur Chu, a writer originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and Mackenzie Jones, a teacher and PhD student from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And excited as I was to see Arthur back, and much as I love Mackenzie, the fact that David is running quiz bowl type competitions as his job, I was like, it's going to be Dave.
I felt he was the favorite for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Jeopardy round categories here are Flat Earth, pick a card, any card, mammals, forward TV synopses, magazines, and sporty talk. Remember when Arthur Chu was the big news-making Jeopardy villain for his, seven-game winning streak where he bounced around a little bit?
Yeah. A lot of people found Arthur Chu very Irritating.
Yeah.
Whatever at this point.
12 games. Okay. 12 games, right? 11 mm-hmm. game winning streak, lost on the 12th. Okay. Yeah. People got their buttons so pushed by Arthur Chu.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mackenzie really held her own here.
Yeah, she did, which isn't surprising. I mean, I remember her being good.
Yeah. Of course. She's good. Yeah, of course.
But I agree, compared to the people she's going up against, it was like, yeah, all right. We had a triple miss in the sporty talk category at the $800 level. Someone who comes in to finish a job, or Joe Torre in the Cardinals lineup. Arthur Engen didn't offer a response. David came in with, what's a pinch hitter? And Mackenzie also said, what is a closer? But that's a cleanup man, or cleanup hitter.
Mm-hmm.
$400 level of mammals. Bloat is the word for a group of these huge mammals, and Uganda's Kazinga Channel has plenty of bloats. Mackenzie guessed what's a gorilla. That's a hippo. Arthur got it. I don't think I knew that a group of hippos was a bloat.
Mm-hmm.
A bloat of hippos.
A bloat of hippos. It's a good one.
It sounds offensive, though. I mean, I'm sure the hippos don't care.
And uncomfortable.
It does sound uncomfortable. That's, you know what? Maybe that's why they're so grumpy all the time.
Yeah. Oh, I liked the $200 level of magazines. I think this came up in a quiz that I wrote a couple of years back. One of America's most widely circulated magazines is this Warehouse Club's connection with latest finds, member polls, and more. And Mackenzie got that. That's Costco. The Costco magazine and the AARP magazine both have higher circulation than any like paid subscription magazine. It's a surprising fact.
Daily Double number one is in Flat Earth at the $800 level. It's only pick number 3, so it's very early. Arthur finds it. He's at 800. Mackenzie's at 600. David's at 0. He bets 1,000 and gets the clue. The Alkali Flat can be found on this New Mexico National Park that's surrounded by a famous missile range. And he gets it correct with what is White Sands. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Mackenzie's at 2,200. Arthur's in the lead at 6,400. And David is at 4,200. Double Jeopardy categories are Supreme Court Justices, Short Shakespeare, Religious Ranks and Titles, Museums Spread Their Wings, World Star, and Feeling Jittery.
I was so sure that there was going to be a reversal at the $2,000 level of Short Shakespeare. The clue was Saintly Day of Henry V's stirring speech, and I am quite sure that I heard Arthur say, what is St. Crispian's Day? And I don't think that that is a correct pronunciation or justifiable. St. Crispin's Day is what that was called. But either I misheard or, you know, the judges decided it was adequate.
Yeah.
I was so sure there was going to be a reversal. I kept waiting for an announcement as we headed into the next Daily Double after that. And then after Final Jeopardy, and I was like, okay, I guess they're going with it. Not to be pedantic, right? Like,
sure, but the rule is if it sounds like you change the spelling with your pronunciation, right, then it doesn't count. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Felt so bad for Mackenzie at the $800 level of World Star. This actress starred in the Chaplin-esque Indian film Barfi before landing in Quantico in 2015. Mackenzie rang in and said, who is Priyanka Chopra Jonas? And that is so many letters to get right. She added an extra R in there. It is Priyanka, not Priyanka.
Yeah. And like we just said, if you change the spelling with your pronunciation,
mm-hmm. Yep.
It is incorrect.
Yeah. Daily Double number 2 is at the $1,600 level of Religious Ranks and Titles. Pick number 5, David finds it. He's at 5,400 at this point, with Mackenzie at 2,600 and Arthur at 7,600. David wagers 5,000, so not quite everything, and he gets the clue. Familiar from Monty Python sketches, this word for an Anglican or Episcopal priest is from the Latin for substitute, and he figures it out. It's vicar. Is it familiar from Monty Python sketches? That's just a word that I use.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. I also don't know, because I'm not a big Monty Python fan, but sure.
Yeah.
And Daily Double number 3 is in Feeling Jittery at the $1,600 level. Pick number 15. Arthur finds this one. He's at 13,200. Mackenzie's at 2,200. And David is just ahead at 14,000. And Arthur makes a big move. He wagers 10,000. He wants to try and put this game in his pocket. Gets the clue. It describes someone weakened by nerves. And also the instrument here. And they show one. I didn't like this instrument clue. I thought it was misleading. Mm-hmm. Arthur doesn't offer a guess. Ken says you had to notice the violin was unstrung. And so they were looking for unstrung. For me, I was like, okay, what's an actual music, like a term that is used in music, right? Like
yeah.
to refer to an instrument. I felt like that clue hurt rather than helped.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. anyway, Arthur drops down pretty far, which makes it hard for mm-hmm. the rest of the game.
So at the end of the double Jeopardy round, Mackenzie's at 600. Arthur's made it back up to 5,600, but that is not enough to break David's lock. This is our second lock game out of the two this week. David's at 18,400. The final Jeopardy category is elements, and the clue is, in his natural history, Pliny described it as argentum vivum. And Mackenzie wrote, "What is going on?" Hi, Tuesday Book Club. I love her. She wagered $10. She drops to $590. Arthur got it correct with "What is mercury?" and a $0 wager. He'll finish in second place. And David also got it correct and wagered $1. So he has 18,401 and is heading to the semifinals. I wonder whether at some point one of these lock games is going to make Mike Davies rethink his wild card spots, make people not play as seriously position, yeah. right? Because like, I understand what he's trying to say, but also not having wild card spots creates situations where it's a foregone conclusion with six or seven clues left on the board, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if someone gets a big daily double and jumps out, which is the meta right now, right?
Yep. It's, mm-hmm. it's that's the, what you have to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes it so that the entire last half of a game could
like the
not
game
matter.
Is over, right? Yeah. Like
and there's
just
nothing
done.
To play for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like playing for second place does matter. And it affects wagering.
Mm-hmm.
Like yeah. I disagree entirely with his assessment. I think it's
yeah.
correct.
Yes. I'm sitting here like, is he going to see it? Is he going to see it soon? Maybe like maybe he had to see it to get it.
We shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. I think it's extremely unlikely that he would backpedal on that.
Yeah. 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 Oh. I don't know. Given his propensity to bring people back, being like, they did a good job, but they didn't win.
That's fair. That's fair. Like, okay. All right. Yeah, I see.
Like, that was what the whole wildcard thing was for, the tournaments.
Yeah,
that's it's for
true.
People who did a good job but didn't happen to win their game. All right. Anyway.
So, David Madden moves on to the semifinals, and we get to Wednesday when we have the contestants Brandon Blackwell, a writer and TV personality originally from Jamaica, mm-hmm. New York, Jennifer Quayle, a wine tasting consultant from Dowagiac, Michigan, and Alex Jacob, an online trivia league host from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm just going to take this opportunity to once again to remind listeners that a few years ago at this point, I hosted a game on the Triviality podcast, which also featured Alex Jacob as one of the players.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's my Alex Jacob connection. Anyway, mm-hmm. the Jeopardy round categories are trending, musical instruments, equine words, auto parts 101, cruise lines, and ports of call. Mm-hmm. Emily, who'd you have? Who was your favorite for this one?
I thought it was going to be Alex Jacob. Although we talked before the podcast recording and I had not looked up Brandon Blackwell's bona fides, and I am a Jeopardy snob. I only pay attention to Jeopardy, so I was missing some information. Kyle, who did you think was going to win?
I thought Brandon would be the favorite, just mm-hmm. given his like public face, and I mean he's a chaser on the chase, mm-hmm. and
yeah, I didn't.
You don't get hired to be a you don't get hired to be a chaser if you're not really good. So I felt that Brandon was the favorite. I thought that Alex would have a shot. I thought that Alex would put up a really good fight, and it, you know, depending on how the daily doubles went and whatever, that Alex could win. And I, you know, no shade on Jennifer, but just like comparing like trivia accomplishments, I was like, I don't see Jennifer coming out on top in this one.
Yeah, fair.
So anyway, to the Jeopardy round. I didn't realize that very first clue of the round, the $800 level of trending. Co-founder Tom Anderson was your first friend on this social media platform. In 2005, he sold his company. Alex got it. That's MySpace. I didn't realize Tom sold MySpace in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I was on MySpace in 2006 and 2007. Mm. and he was my friend, but he didn't. He was lying to me. God, MySpace was weird. Thinking back
it
to
was,
that.
Yeah,
it was weird. It was weird.
Yeah,
but beautiful. Beautiful in that early 2000s weird internet way.
Yes.
You know what MySpace didn't do? Allow what? Foreign powers to interfere in an election. I'll tell you that. MySpace didn't do that.
You have something there. I've come across the children, the youth of today, I don't know, on some app being like, what if when people went to your page, a song that you liked played? Like,
what?
Everything old is new again.
You've come full circle.
MySpace.
Yes. Welcome back. Welcome back, children.
They're also embracing a whole bunch of 90s fashion trends that I'm like, oh no, oh no, 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 no.
Yeah.
No, stop. No. It was a bad idea the first time. Put it back.
Leave it in the past. Leave it in the past, please. Mm-hmm. Also, this apparently is, I don't know if it's making a comeback per se, but the $600 level, the manual for this robotic 90s toy said, you can feed me by inserting your fingertip in my mouth. That was a triple stumper. Nobody tried it. It's a Furby. One of my nieces showed up at our house around Christmas time with a little Furby. And I was like, how have they escaped from hell? Who broke
Who
these seals?
This?
Like, what? Ah. And then she left it at her house.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
And I don't even know who makes Furby, but it's like the designers, like on purpose, make it so you can't turn it off.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, you just have to wait for it to fall asleep. I'm like, but that doesn't work with my own kids. How? Like, what?
Ugh. Yeah.
Alex Jacob apparently knows his Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah.
He got the whole category.
Yes. Yes, he did. I was surprised at the $1,000 level. I don't know, maybe because like a lot of these are movies that came out before or after my teen years, I guess. The $1,000 level, Tom Cruise tells Max von Sydow in this flick, if you don't kill me, precogs were wrong and pre-crime is over. That's Minority Report. I was like 16 the summer Minority Report came out. I think I saw it like multiple times because it like wasn't a great summer for movies.
I think I recall that. Yeah. I had the same feeling. I knew that one, but I didn't recognize the line from like Cocktail.
Yeah.
And the fact that it had precog in it, was like, that's a little bit easy for a $1,000 clue.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Your car problems came up at the $400 level. The star method is used to tighten these fasteners. There was a picture. Follow each with the one diagonally opposite. And Alex got that. That is luck nuts.
Yeah. It's also a good idea to loosen them that way. However, if they're on there so tight and apparently rusted to the stud, then even when you stand on your tire iron to try to get them loose, apparently you'll just break it right off.
Yeah.
So
love that.
Don't
for
do
you.
That. Yeah.
Daily Double number one is in musical instruments at the $1,000 level. It's pick number three. We're getting to them super early. I think that the contestants are not really Daily Double hunting early. We've just been hitting them early this tournament. So Brandon uncovers it. He's only at 800, tied with Alex. Jennifer's at zero because Brandon and Alex have gotten one clue apiece at this point. Brandon wagers 1,000, and his clue is also known as an etherophone. This boxy electronic instrument was used by the Beach Boys, and he gets it correct. That is a theremin. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Alex is at 6,600, Jennifer's at 1,600, Brandon is at 6,200, and the double Jeopardy categories are during James Buchanan's presidency, architects, world literature, music collabs, I've got a bone to pick with you, and the three R's. The letter R will appear three times in each correct response.
Jennifer did really well in the bone category, which Jeopardy people know things. It just didn't strike me as a thing that seems like would be really in her wheelhouse, but she got 4 out of 5, and the last one was a triple stumper.
Mm-hmm.
We had a triple stumper at the bottom of the music collabs category, $2,000 level. Billie Holiday and this sax player first linked up in 1934. Soon enough, they gave each other nicknames, Lady Day and Prez. Jennifer rang in and guessed a saxophone player, Charlie Parker. His nickname was Bird. And there was no getting away from that. Brandon rang in and went a little deeper and went with who's Rollins, Sonny Rollins. But it is Lester Young, who is among, like, I don't know, hard to put like a tier list of saxophone players, but like in terms of like the time frame within the jazz age that they were playing, Sonny Rollins, Lester Young, Horace Silver are, I would put them in the same kind of category. So I could I could see his brain kind of like trying to pick one. And I think he just picked wrong.
Yeah.
The $1,600 level of architects yet again brought up the fact that I have the hardest time keeping two names separate. The clue was, with his impressive Duomo in Florence, he was called the architect who renewed Roman masonry work. Alex got it. That's Brunelleschi. And for some reason, my brain is like, but Brunelleschi and Bernini, for some reason, have to be the same person. And so when I think of one, the other name comes up, and I'm always like, well, there's no way of knowing which one this is. There's no historical record that could confirm whether it was Brunelleschi or Bernini doing that thing. So I have work to do there.
Yeah, I hear you. I was not going to be able to pull that name.
Daily Double number two is in during James Buchanan's presidency at the $1,200 level. Pick number six. Jennifer finds it. She's at 5,600. Alex is at 6,600. Brandon is at 6,200. It's a very close game. And she wagers 5,000 and gets the clue. On December 2nd, 1859, he rode to the gallows on his coffin and remarked, "This is a beautiful country." And she got it correct with, who is John Brown?
Yeah. I just read The Good Lord Bird, which I think I heard of because there was a Jeopardy category about the miniseries based on it. But it's a novel where John Brown is, you know, a fictional, it is a fictionalization of, it's not like strictly historically based. The protagonist, I think, is entirely invented, but John Brown features prominently. It was pretty good, I thought.
Cool.
Anyway, Daily Double number three is in world literature at the $800 level. Brandon finds it at pick number 17. He's at 11,400 with Alex at 13,400 and Jennifer at 9,000. He makes it a true Daily Double, which is what you have to do in this tournament format. And he gets the clue. In this Hermann Hesse novel, Harry Holler reads a treatise about his dual inner self caught between a man and a lupine creature. And we were just talking about Hesse and that there are just a couple Hesse books that we would really expect Jeopardy to ask about. This was one of them. Unlike the super difficult boards that they were throwing out recently, Brandon gets this correct. It is Steppenwolf.
Yep. So at the end of Double Jeopardy, Alex is at 14,200, Jennifer's at 11,000, and Brandon's at 23,600. This is a competitive game going into the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
The final Jeopardy category is old words, and the clue, first appearing in an English dictionary in 1623, Mezonoxian means pertaining to this word. Jennifer got it correct with what midnight? And she wagered everything. Mezzo meaning middle, nox meaning night. So Mezonoxian is midnight. Alex wrote, what is I heart you, Sabrina? It is sweet. It is sweet. And it is incorrect. And
I'm sure he does, but
everything. No. Yeah. Oh, that's true. It is probably a true statement.
It does not answer
the question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He wagered everything. And so he drops down to zero. And Brandon wrote, what is asleep? Which is incorrect. And he wagered 4801, which is a cover bet. And so he drops down to 18,799, which means that Jennifer Quayle gets that semifinal spot from this game.
Yeah, she was astounded. I think she said, what just happened?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Yeah.
But she played well enough to stay in it. You know, she earned the spot. It wasn't some weird fluke thing. Like, she kept herself in the game. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we've seen people in similar positions lose by not knowing how to wager in this situation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she kept within reach and she knew what to do in the situation she was in. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this is, I would consider this one an upset for sure.
I agree. But yeah, that's how things go. That's why final matters.
Yeah. So Thursday, our contestants are Monica Tiu, a postdoctoral scientist from Atlanta, Georgia, Chuck Forrest, a lawyer from Marino, Italy, and Sam Cavanaugh, an educator from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Who do you like
for
this one?
Good to see Sam back.
Yes.
This was hard. This was very hard for me to pick because Sam Kavanaugh is a Tournament of Champions winner. When he was in the Tournament of Champions, he really impressed me. Mm-hmm. Like he to me was a strong favorite throughout. Monica has been around. She was in the All-Star game and I have seen her in action. Mm-hmm. Chuck has been gone so long.
Right.
But obviously he's a real contender.
Yeah. So
I truly had no idea. I thought that it would be Monica, but I was like, I really could see it being anybody.
Yeah, I was also leaning Monica. I think these three players playing against each other in their prime, maybe Chuck Forrest, but like he was what, the 1986?
Yeah, I think, yeah, he was like the first one. Yeah.
TOC winner, right? Like 40 years after winning your TOC, like your buzzer speed's got to be suffering, right? Mm-hmm. Like
I would think so.
I mean, I was not thinking about Jeopardy at this level when I tried to get on it, right? But like I have heard, serious trivia people talk about how do you strike the balance between accruing as much knowledge as you can, which takes time, and like getting in there before your reflexes start to slow, as if you could just pick your moment to be on Jeopardy, like
that's not really up to you. But
but like that's the trade-off that I've heard people talk about age-wise, right? So 40 years after your tournament, like I would be inclined to think that he's going to struggle with the buzzer. Anyway, our Jeopardy round categories are LGBTQ+ writers and their works, Hop on the Interstate, Free for All, Two-Word Pop Culture, Alphanumerics, and Definitions from the Devil's Dictionary, which Monica crushed despite making several comments about not liking that category or being comfortable with it.
Yeah.
She got three of them, the 200 and then the 800 and 1,000. The $1,000 level there, under Q, a sufficient number of members of a deliberative body to have their own way and their own way of having it. That is a quorum. Two-word pop culture, there was a very funny rebound. This catchphrase of Adam McMahon was uttered with creepy efficiency in The Shining. Monica rang in and said, "What is red rum?" Which is uttered in The Shining. And Chuck got the rebound with, "What is he? Here's Johnny."
Yeah, that's more along the lines of what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Ugh, that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Very first clue was a triple stumper, the $800 level of free-for-all. The Wilmette Proviso, which wanted no slavery in newly acquired Mexican lands, was a precursor to this political party. Chuck rang in and went with, I guess, the neg bait and said, "What's the Republican Party?" That's incorrect. And Sam came in with, "What's the Whig Party?" That's the wrong time period for the Whigs. That's the Free Soil Party.
Yep.
That was like their one thing. they had one plank in their platform, and that was exactly that.
Yeah.
All right. Daily Double number one is in Hop on the Interstate. It's at pick number 18, $600 level, and Sam finds it. He's at 400. Chuck is at 2,000. Monica is at 3,800. And he wagers 1,000. And gets the clue, Columbia is about midway between these two same state Midwest cities that squared off in the I-70 World Series of 1985. Sam sees Columbia and I think thinks Columbus, goes to the wrong state and guesses what are Cleveland and Cincinnati, but Columbia's in Missouri, so they're looking for Kansas City and St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So he drops back down, but he manages to claw his way out of the hole. At the end of the Jeopardy round, he's at 200, Chuck is at 2,600, and Monica is at 8,200. Double Jeopardy categories are British explorers, art terms, science, round here, tough vocab, and hip-hop, which is about hip-hop daddies. That sounded weird.
Oh.
Hip-hop artists who are fathers and their offspring. No, you know what? I'm sticking with it. I said what I said.
I didn't know the response to the $800 level of round here, but I felt like it was a funny moment. This numeral is topmost center on a standard circular dartboard. And they all just looked at each other like, we've been busy learning trivia.
How much time have we spent in a bar playing darts, Ken?
It's 20.
I did know it was 20. I don't know how I knew it was 20. I've played darts maybe a total of 2 hours in my life and not since I was a teenager, but... Mm-hmm. Somehow I knew that.
Yeah, I did not remember it.
I liked Monica's response at the $1,200 of round here. In legend, the Siege Perilous was a seat at King Arthur's Round Table reserved for the knight destined to do this. And Monica went in with, "What is kill him?" Yeah, Ken noted that would be a very aggro table.
Yeah.
No, it's for the knight who would find the grail.
Mm-hmm. Daily double number 2 is at the $1,600 level of art terms, and Sam finds it at pick number 2. So early. So early.
So early.
Yeah. And he had struggled in the Jeopardy round, so he's just at $200 still. And Chuck's at $2,600. Monica's at $8,200. Sam can wager up to $2,000, so he does wager $2,000, and he gets the clue. Jean Arp coined this term for Alexander Calder's inert sculptures, often made from sheet metal. And Sam figures it out. Stabiles, like not mobiles. But stables.
Yeah. But I thought that was impressive. I was like, cool.
Wait, yeah.
Also, I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he just knew that, but like, I think that he puzzled it out there on the stage, which,
yeah,
you know, I think, the work in.
I think he didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Daily Double number 3 is the next pick. Back to back.
Sam finds it. Sam is like, I did not want to find both of these this early. Like, you can
like
see
right
it.
Now. Like,
this was not the plan.
It's at the $1,200 level of science. And at this point, he is now up to $2,200. So he wagers $2,200 and gets the clue. Devised by a 19th century German scientist, this scale measures a mineral's resistance to abrasion, and he gets it correct with what is Mohs hardness scale.
Yeah. So that puts him between Chuck and Monica, and then he just kind of keeps pace. They all kind of, their lines, you know, kind of all climb together. And at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Monica's at 15,800, Sam is at 12,000, Chuck is at 11,000. Great scores. Great recovery by Sam after a tough Jeopardy round. He really recovered and, you know, stayed in there. The final Jeopardy category is 20th century books. And the clue is time mentioned cruelty and enforced conformity when summing up this novel with a stonily silent narrator. This was a triple stumper. I considered the correct response and then discarded it mentally because I was wrong about who the narrator was. So Chuck tries what is Lord of the Flies. That is not correct. He's wagered 4801. That drops him to 6199. Sam tried what is 1984. He wagered 4400. That drops him to 7600. He's ahead of Chuck. And Monica also responds, what is 1984? And I'm really here, Mom.
That's sweet.
And yeah, Monica wagered 8201. So drops to $75.99, $1 below Sam.
Yeah,
that was Sam's plan. Sam figured out.
It had to be.
Yeah, so by $1, because everybody here can do math and understands wagering strategy, Sam wins this game and will go on to the semifinals. And I'm thrilled for him because I've been kind of rooting for him ever since the, what was it? It was like the previous TOC winner and the subsequent one had been like invited back for, I don't know, All-Stars or whatever.
Yeah.
I've been wanting redemption for Sam ever since.
I don't remember. I think it was Masters.
It might be Masters.
It was like, we're bringing back the finalists from the Tournament of Champions, despite the fact that some of them didn't win it.
Right.
And we're bringing back James Holzhauer from the previous Tournament of Champions. And, you know, it was just like, well, we're just going to pretend that Sam's tournament didn't happen, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm very happy for him. I think he has kind of a, maybe a redemption kind of arc that he's working toward.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm here for it.
Yeah, me too. And that brings us to Friday, when we have the contestants Ben Ingram, a business control specialist originally from Florence, South Carolina, Dhruv Gar, a grad student from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Victoria Gross, a writer and television personality from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Going into this, Emily, what are your thoughts on these players?
Now I've learned what it means when somebody says on Jeopardy that they're a television personality. And I shouldn't be like, I don't really remember them, but I remember Dhruv and Ben. This time I was like, let me look up what kind of television personality we're talking about. And yeah, I'm leaning Victoria on this one, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Victoria is a force to be reckoned with, not only a chaser on The Chase, but as far as I understand, one of the perennial powerhouses in the quizzing world. So yeah, my money, if I had money on it, my money would be on Victoria. Ben is a known entity, of course. you know, we've seen him before, we've seen him back. Always expect a strong game. I wanted my boy Dhruv to win, though.
Yeah.
Of course, I was like, that's my boy.
Yeah.
Oh, Dhruv.
Yeah, and Ben comes from a town in South Carolina that's near to where some of my family lives. So my nephew, who's now on his way to college, I think when he was like, maybe he was 8, and dressed up for Halloween as Ben Ingram. I have a picture of him somewhere with his fully constructed cardboard Jeopardy podium that like hung over his shoulders with a strap. It was great. It was a great look.
That was awesome.
Yeah. So I have a special place in my heart for Ben Ingram because of that.
Yeah. Ben is one of the people who reached out to me, I think, after the Tournament of Champions that I was in. Just like, you know, offered congratulations and stuff. And we chatted a bit. So,
yeah.
The Jeopardy round categories are the Ancients Speak, State Flags, a Stand Out, Stand Up, Penalties and Bonuses, Classic Ad Slogans and Jingles, and 13 Letter Words. State Flags, man. I knew all of these ones. I missed a daily double on State Flags in the tournament, though. It haunts me to this day.
I don't remember that one.
Basically, it was like, what flag has a diamond on it because it produces diamonds? And I was like, I don't know. And that's Arkansas. Apparently, Arkansas makes diamonds.
Huh.
Anyway, we had a rebound at the $600 level. Representations of the North Star and This Other Night Sky feature appear on Alaska's flag. Ben did the right thing and went general and said, what is the Dipper? He was told to be more specific. And he guessed what's the Little Dipper. It's incorrect. Teed it up for Dhruv to take it with the Big Dipper.
Yeah, once you've heard that, be more specific, it's a coin flip, right?
Yeah. I mean, unless you know it. But
if you
don't, then you're like, okay. Either I will get it or the next person will get it.
Yeah. Fun sequencing, classic ad slogans and jingles. At the $800 level, pick number 13, this brand has been advertised as 2-2-2 mints in one. And Victoria tries what is double mint. That's incorrect. Turns into a triple stumper. Certs was the right answer there. And then at the $200 level, pick number 29, double your pleasure, double your fun with this brand. And Victoria gets it again. And this time says double mint and is correct.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Yeah. When the wrong answer comes back as a right answer.
Yeah. And it's nice when the person who guessed it the first time can get it, but it's also funny when they don't.
Yeah.
Yes, enjoy that a lot.
Daily double number one is in the Ancient Speak at the $800 level. It's pick number 10 and Dhruv finds it. Way to go, Dhruv. He's at 3,400. He's out to an early lead with Victoria at 1,800 and Ben at negative 600. He wagers just 2,000. I would have gone bigger here.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and he gets the clue. In the lives of the 12 Caesars, it said that his last words were, what an artist dies with me. And Dhruv gets it correct. It's Nero. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Victoria has now taken the lead. She's at 7,600. Dhruv is at 5,200. Ben is at negative 200. And the Double Jeopardy categories are South American history, plays and playwrights, biology ABCs, a warming trend, Mr. or Mrs. song, and eponyms. Tough break for Ben at the $1,200 level of eponyms. Last name of Belgian inventor Adolf, who lent his name to a brass wind instrument that ranges in type from sopranino to bass. His last name was not saxophone. Nope. As Ben guessed, the instrument is the saxophone. The last name in question is sax. Dhruv got the rebound on that one.
Mm-hmm. I think Adolf Sax has come up before on Jeopardy, like recently, because I feel like I've talked a little bit about the bizarre life of Adolf Sax. He had some stuff. He had some stuff go on, and I'm just going to leave it at that because that's not what this is about. The $1,600 level of Mr. or Mrs. Song. I know this, and I will only ever know this because when I was student teaching, I'll read the clue. Avian name of the Adam Duritz band that in the 90s sang Mr. Jones and me tell each other fairy tales. When I was student teaching, my host teacher, he would just sing parts of this song just every day.
Okay.
Because I'm Mr. Jones. And so like, you know, a kid would just like say Mr. Jones and he would just from the side of the room, you know, burst into Mr. Jones and me. And like, I was not really aware of that song before that. But now I cannot become unaware of that song.
Yeah.
From the Counting Crows. Anyway, here I am.
I sort of liked that the fact of the $1,200 level of that category. Paul Simon said this Yankee was baffled by a lyric in Mrs. Robinson telling Paul, I haven't gone anywhere. Ben got that. It's Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, I always wondered about that line. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio?
He's like, oh, I'm still right here.
Yeah. I mean, it like fits the rhyme scheme, I guess. But yeah, I wondered. And apparently, if this clue is to be believed, apparently he just did. He was not consulted before the song was written.
Yeah. The $2,000 level of a warming trend in this Bible book once alluded to by Samuel L. Jackson. Another fire shall devour them, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. Victoria got that. That is Ezekiel. I said it before Ken got through the first phrase, and my daughter's like, of course you know the Bible question.
Oh, like, Mom.
I'm like, that's not why I know it, though.
Let's allow me. Let's go ahead and pull up Pulp Fiction. Let me just educate you, my child.
Yeah, no, we're not going to educate her about Pulp Fiction for a while yet.
Why? Just kidding. Yeah. I do know why. Daily Double number 2 is in South American history. It is at the $800 level. Pick number 5. Ben uncovers it. He is at $1,400. Victoria's at 9,600, Drew is at 5,200. He wagers his maximum 2,000 and gets the clue. Simón Turi Patiño was once Bolivia's Rey del Estaño, king of this metal in which the land is rich. I thought this was pretty hard. He missed it. He guessed what is silver, but Estaño means tin, mm-hmm. which apparently you're supposed to relate to Stannis. I did not.
Yeah, tin is the symbol is SN, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. It is, which like going backward from the answer, I'm like, okay, I see how you get there, but I thought that was pretty tough.
That's a tricky one. And Daily Double number 3 is in Biology ABCs, also at the $800 level. This one is pick number 15, and Drew finds this one. Way to go, Drew.
Yay,
is it 6,400? He is $10,000 behind Victoria, who's at 16,400. Ben's at $200. Drew makes it a true daily double. And he gets the clue. C, in myth, it's a fire-breathing hybrid monster. In genetics, it's an organism with two distinct sets of DNA. And he takes his time with it, but he gets it correct. What is a chimera?
That's right. So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Victoria is at 22,800 without any daily doubles.
That's Drew bonkers.
Is at, yeah. Very good game. Drew is at 14,400. Ben is up to 5,800. Final Jeopardy category is USSRIP. And the clue, of the 15 countries formed by the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, this one is alphabetically last. Gosh, the Jeopardy writers just love this. They love this particular fact. Ben got it correct with what is Uzbekistan? And he wagered 1854, which conveniently brought him to a score of 7654. Which apparently he was not aware of.
No.
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe 1854 is an important date for him. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever. Drew missed it. He didn't get quite far enough in the U's and put what is Ukraine and wagered 8401, which drops him to 5999. And Victoria got it correct with what is Uzbekistan, said hi to her daughter Nora, and made a cover bet of 6001. So she gets to move on. These are good games this week.
Yeah, they really were.
This has been fun, as much as I kind of don't want to admit it, because mm-hmm, I want to be mm-hmm, like, oh, mm-hmm. We're tournamented out. We want to get back to regular games. This has been fun.
This one's great. I like this tournament.
Yeah. I am going to be, I think, even more excited for it next year after we have established our normal routines again. And then we get this to, you know, look forward to.
Yeah.
Assuming that this is a yearly thing. Which I think is the intention.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the end of this week. And we're approaching the end of the quarterfinals. Next week, we'll wrap it up and move on to the semis. But this is the point in the show where we remind you that we have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/potentpotables. You can go to that URL and donate to support us financially. You can slide us a few bucks a month. Helps just keep the podcast going in the black. And if you are a patron, then you get access to things like our quiz questions. Mm-hmm. We put them up before the show is edited. And just in case you ever need some trivia questions and you don't want to take the time to think of them yourself, there you go. You have a ready-made pool of questions to choose from. So you can go there, patreon.com/potentpotables. And of course, every week we want to just make sure that we couch all of our, you know, money grubbing with the recognition that there are things that are more important than a podcast. And we encourage you to check out the show notes to follow some of those causes that we think are worthwhile. Mm-hmm. So, Emily,
yes,
tell me what you think we're going to talk about.
We had two triple stumper final Jeopardies this week. So I am going to start by guessing Al Capone.
And you would be correct. We're talking about Al Capone. That was the Monday triple stumper, notorious figures. The clue is about his nickname, claiming it came from a shrapnel wound in World War One, but it wasn't. That's not true. It was Al Capone. And I was like, you know what? If I could talk about Al Capone, Al Capone was one of the first correct responses I gave on Jeopardy.
That's true.
It wasn't the first one. I think Guinness was the first one. And when we were having our watch party and I got, you know, Guinness and then Capone, my dad announced to the room, "That's my boy, beer and gangsters." I was like, all right. All right. So anyway, yeah, we're going to talk about Al Capone a little bit,
nice.
Which was nice for me because I was like, you know, I know things about Al Capone, but I haven't put it together into like one cohesive kind of narrative. So this was fun for me to look into. Yeah. So let's get into it. Alphonse Gabriel Capone was born January 17th, 1899. Sometimes he was known by his nickname Scarface, which, of course, the clue was referring to. He was a gangster and businessman. He found his notoriety during the Prohibition era as the co-founder and boss of the Chicago Outfit from 1925 to 1931. He went to prison at the age of 33, which I kind of knew that, but it hit me that, like, that's younger than me. What have I done with my life? You know, Al Capone had already established himself as a figure in American history and gone to prison, and I'm just here making a podcast, you know? My life has passed me by.
Yeah, you should be more like Al Capone.
I should be more like Al Capone. That's, you know, I've been saying that for years. Uh-huh. Everyone's been telling me that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was born in Brooklyn. His parents were Italian immigrants, Gabriel Capone and Teresa Capone. His father was a barber. His mother was a seamstress. His family had emigrated to the United States in 1893 by ship, and they settled in the Navy Yard section of Brooklyn. And when he was age 11, they moved to Park Slope, which I don't know where that is, but you might.
I do, yeah. It's right now it's kind of a little bougie
hipster place.
Yeah, bougie hipster. Yeah.
Okay. It was not at that time. It was a place for, you know, poor immigrants. His parents had eight other children. I'm not going to name them all, but some of them died young. Others did not. His brothers, Ralph and Frank, worked with Al in his criminal empire, and others, you know, did other things. He showed promise as a student, but had trouble with the rules at the strict parochial Catholic school that he attended. He was expelled at the age of 14. For hitting a female teacher in the face. Not a great start to life there.
Yeah, don't love that.
Yeah, me neither. He married May Josephine Coughlin at the age of 19 in 1918. She was Irish Catholic and had earlier that month given birth to their first son, Albert Sonny Capone. Sonny Capone lived until 2004. Albert Sonny lost most of his hearing in his left ear as a child. Apparently, by all accounts, they had a happy marriage. Although Al Capone was known to be a bit of a womanizer as his notoriety rose, but all accounts are that they truly did have a happy marriage, which I don't know, it's kind of like incongruous with the figure of a, you know, a gangster boss. Anyway, he became involved in small-time gangs in New York, included the Junior 40 Thieves, the Bowery Boys, then the Brooklyn Rippers, and then the Five Points Gang. He was mentored by a guy named Frankie Yale, who was a bartender at a Coney Island dance hall. It was when he was working with Frankie Yale that he inadvertently insulted a woman while he was working the door at this place. I think it's called the Harvard Inn. And apparently he was slashed with a knife 3 times on the left side of his face by her brother, which is supposedly the actual origin of his name, Scarface. He hated that nickname. There are inconsistencies reported about this, you know, event, like when it happened or like how it specifically happened. He was definitely known as Scarface, and he definitely hated it. He tried to hide the left side of his face when he was being photographed, and he did, you know, like the clue said, claim that they were war wounds, which is not true. Apparently, he was called Snorky by his close friends, which I guess was a term for a sharp dresser. Doesn't sound like a nice thing to call someone, but I guess whatever.
Yeah. Huh.
In 1919, he left New York for Chicago, and he began as a bouncer at a brothel, where it is thought that that's most likely where he contracted syphilis, which became a problem throughout his entire life. He bought a small house in the Park Manor neighborhood of Chicago's South Side around that time. He got involved in the bootlegging business. The Chicago outfit was, you know, primarily known for bootlegging alcohol, especially as Prohibition took hold. He worked under a man named Torrio, and Torrio headed an essentially Italian organized crime group that was the biggest in Chicago that became known as the Chicago Outfit. Capone was his right-hand man. Torrio was wary of being drawn into gang wars and tried to negotiate agreements over territory between different groups, like the Northside Gang, who was led by Dean O'Banion, the Jenna Brothers, and then some other groups as well. Torrio eventually arranged the murder of O'Banion at his flower shop in 1924, which put a guy named Jaime Weiss at the head of that game. And he was backed by Vincent Drucci and Bugs Moran, who are kind of like gangster names that have been known. Weiss had been a close friend of O'Banion, and the Northsiders made it a priority to get revenge on his killers. So we get Prohibition rolling up. Capone was involved with Canadian bootleggers who helped him smuggle liquor into the U.S. There was an ambush in January 1925 that left Capone shaken but unhurt, presumably by the Northsiders. And 12 days later, Torrio was returning from a shopping trip when he was shot several times. Although he didn't die, he did kind of like resign and turned over control of the Chicago outfit to Capone. And so at age 26, Al Capone became the most powerful mobster in Chicago. His network, again, was primarily based on bootlegging and, you know, providing illegal breweries and transportation. And he had political and law enforcement protection as well. He became well known for using violence to increase his influence and revenue. Any establishment that refused to purchase liquor from Capone often got blown up. And as many as 100 people were killed during such bombings during the 1920s. An interesting thing that Capone did was he would enlist the help of local members of the black community in his operations. And he was a big fan of jazz. And so he would reach out to jazz musicians or their families or people involved in the jazz scene, such as Milt Hinton and Lionel Hampton. They both had relatives who worked for Capone on the South Side. He even sent 2 bodyguards to accompany jazz pianist Earl Hines on a road trip. Yeah. He was an ostentatious man. He indulged in custom suits, cigars, gourmet food and drink, and female companionship. He described himself simply as a businessman satisfying a public demand. But he was well aware that he kind of made himself a public figure. He was not trying to be subtle necessarily. He based himself in Cicero, and through various means of intimidation or bribery, corruption, such, he took over council elections, which made it difficult for the Northsiders to target him. There were a lot of like back and forth violent acts between the Chicago outfit and the Northsiders, and eventually Weiss was killed outside the Northsiders headquarters at O'Banion's former flower shop. He also had a feud with a man named Joe Aiello. Aiello was another, obviously, gangster. He was a man who thought that he would be selected to be the head of the Unione Siciliana, which was a Sicilian-American organization, like sort of political machine sort of thing among Italian-Americans. And it was based in Chicago. Aiello thought that he was going to be the one named to head it, and it turned out that Capone's consigliere, Antonio Lombardo, ended up being named the head of that. He felt that that was Capone's like meddling and exerting influence, and had like basically decided to have a vendetta against Capone about that. He allied himself with other enemies of Capone, and there were a number, I'm not going to give the specifics, there were a number of different attempts on Capone's life. One involved trying to bribe a chef to put prussic acid in his soup. Others included just like putting out a massive like $50,000 bounty on anyone who managed to kill Capone. Despite all of these attempts and all of these things, Capone was just like untouchable, and anyone who came after him just ended up dead. Still, eventually, Aiello was arrested for hiring someone to kill Capone. And then the intimidation that he faced afterward caused him to suffer a nervous breakdown, or so he claimed, and he disappeared to New Jersey to live with relatives. Capone had a lot of politicians on his side. He, you know, supported certain people like William Hale Thompson, who had campaigned on a platform of not enforcing prohibition and hinted that he'd reopen illegal saloons. He accepted about $250,000 from Capone for his campaign, and he beat Democratic candidate William Emmett Dever in the 1927 mayoral race. In 1928, on the day of the so-called Pineapple Primary, voting booths were targeted by Capone's bomber, James Belcastro, in wards where it seemed like Thompson's opponents were thought to have a support, and it caused the deaths of at least 15 people. Belcastro and four policemen were charged for these crimes, but all charges were dropped after key witnesses recanted their statements. Another important event that's associated with Capone is the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which most people have heard of. He was assumed to be responsible for ordering it. It was Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1929, although Capone was at his Florida home at the time of the massacre. It was an attempt to eliminate Bugs Moran, who was now the head of the Northside Gang, and there could be any number of reasons. You know, they had a lot of animosity. One reason could be that a shipment of illegal whiskey had been hijacked as it was going down the Detroit River toward Cook County. So the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, four of Capone's henchmen, who were dressed up as cops, went into Moran's headquarters. It's a trucking warehouse and garage, and claimed to be on a police raid. They lined up the seven men who were there along a wall and then signaled accomplices to come in, who came in and just gunned them down. Photographs of the slain victims were published, which shocked the public and damaged Capone's image. In an effort to clean up his image, Capone donated to charities and sponsored a soup kitchen in Chicago during the Depression. So, you know, gangsters, you know, they don't always do bad things.
They're just like us. They're not just like us.
Yeah. Capone was known for, you know, having his men do his dirty work for him. Obviously, that's how he stayed out of prison for so long, when everyone knew what he was doing, but you couldn't pin anything on him because he never was the one who actually did anything. Supposedly, in May 1929, a plot was uncovered that three of his men, Albert Anselmi, John Scalise, and Joseph Junta, or Junta, I guess, had been persuaded by Aiello, remember the big guy who hated him, to depose Capone and take over the Chicago outfit. Capone found out about this. The story goes that he beat the three men with a baseball bat and then ordered his bodyguards to shoot them. That scene is in The Untouchables, you know, the movie from 1987. Mm-hmm. It comes from, like, you know, reports, like newspaper reports from the 30s. It seems unlikely that that's actually what happened, but it certainly, like, paints a picture of Capone as, you know, ruthless and, like, capable of doing great harm himself. Eventually, Capone's men tracked Aiello to Rochester, New York, and plotted to kill him there, but Aiello returned to Chicago before that, and then he was shot on October 23rd at least 13 times and died. And so that was the end of that feud. In the wake of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the federal government started to get more involved. Chicago started to look bad on the outside, and the people in Chicago didn't want that. So they reached out to Herbert Hoover to, like, get people involved and start to clean this up. A multi-agency attack on Capone began, with the Treasury and Justice Departments trying to figure out ways that they can, you know, pin something on him. And this is where we start to get the movement to figure out how, like, we could get him for tax evasion, some kind of tax prosecution. This is also when the Prohibition Bureau agents led by Elliot Ness, that is in the movie The Untouchables, which, if you've never seen The Untouchables, it's a good movie. Not entirely historically accurate, but it's enjoyable. They were sent to Chicago to, you know, try and get something, try and figure out a way to solve this problem. On March 27, 1929, he was arrested by FBI agents as he left a Chicago courtroom after testifying to a grand jury that was investigating violations of federal prohibition laws. He was charged with contempt of court for feigning illness to avoid appearing earlier. On May 16, 1929, he was arrested in Philadelphia for carrying a concealed weapon. On May 17, 1929, he was indicted by a grand jury and trial was held in Philadelphia. He entered a guilty plea and was sentenced to a prison term of 1 year. He was released in March 1930, and he was listed as number one public enemy on the unofficial Chicago Crime Commission's widely publicized list. He was arrested for vagrancy charges in April 1930. In 1931, he was tried on a contempt of court charge as well. He was sentenced to 6 months, but he remained free while on appeal. In February 1930, his organization was linked to the murder of Julius Rosenheim, who served as a police informant in the Chicago outfit for 28 years. But it was, of course, tax evasion, as we probably all know, that brought him down. In 1927, there had been a case, United States versus Sullivan, that said the approach was legally sound to claim that illegally earned income was still subject to income tax. And that's what this whole thing is based around. Right. Like, even if, you know, you've got ill-gotten booty, you still owe us income tax on it. And so the key to Capone's conviction on tax charges was not his spending, but proving his income. And the most valuable evidence in that regard originated in his offer to pay tax. Capone's brother Ralph had been tried for tax evasion in 1930. And so, seeking to avoid the same fate, Al Capone ordered his lawyer to regularize his tax position. But his lawyer made crucial admissions when stating the income that Capone was willing to pay tax on for various years. And without any investigation, you know, this lawyer just like handed them information that told them like, oh, he's had massive amounts of income that he hasn't paid tax on. And so he was charged for income tax evasion for 1924. And he was indicted on June 5th, 1931 on 22 counts from 25 through 29. And he pled guilty on June 16th. 1931. However, on July 30th, the prosecutor refused to honor the plea bargain and they rescinded the guilty plea. So it went to trial. He was convicted. He was sent to Atlanta U.S. Penitentiary in May 1932. He was officially diagnosed with syphilis and gonorrhea at that point. He was also experiencing withdrawal symptoms from cocaine. He stitched soles on shoes for 8 hours a day. He was transferred to Alcatraz in August of 1934. And due to his good behavior, he was permitted to play banjo in the Alcatraz prison band called the Rock Islanders.
Huh.
I love that. I don't know. Like, I just love that. It's just really funny. His decline became increasingly evident. He had syphilis of the brain, formally diagnosed in February of 1938. And he was more and more confused and disoriented as time went on. He was paroled on November 16th, 1939. And he was referred to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore for the treatment of syphilitic paresis. However, Johns Hopkins refused to treat him because of his reputation, but Union Memorial Hospital did. He donated 2 Japanese weeping cherry trees to the Union Memorial Hospital in 1939 out of gratitude. In 1940, he left Baltimore and went to his mansion in Palm Island, Florida. In 1942, he was one of the first Americans to be treated with penicillin, but it was too late for him to reverse the damage to his brain. By 1946, it was concluded that he had the mentality of a 12-year-old child. On January 21st, 1947, he had a stroke and then suffered cardiac arrest on January 22nd. And on the 25th, he died of heart failure. His body was transported back to Chicago a week later and a private funeral was held. He was originally buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Chicago, which is... it's a known cemetery in Chicago. And then in 1950, his remains, along with a number of his family members, were moved to Mount Carmel in Hillside. So that's his life. After his death, Frank Nitti, his underboss, took over as the boss of the outfit. However, Nitti took it very much more underground. You know, Prohibition was repealed and Nitti tried to stay out of the spotlight and turn to things like prostitution, labor union racketeering, and gambling. That's Al Capone. He's been portrayed on screen by a ton of people. I'm not going to go through all of them, but man, a lot. He has appeared in, you know, Boardwalk Empire, Legends of Tomorrow, a movie called Al Capone, in the Untouchables film and the TV show, Revenge of Al Capone, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superbad. Yeah, in The Godfather. Apparently, Capone in the book is one of, like, he sends a couple people after Vito Corleone. They're intercepted, and Corleone tells Capone to not interfere. And apparently, Capone does that. He also appears in The Adventures of Tintin. Tintin. He appears all over and is referred to in a lot of ways. I don't need to go more in depth. So
yeah,
there we go. That's Alphonse Capone.
It was great having that kind of all pieced together. Like, most of what you said sounded familiar, but I think I've encountered it sort of piecemeal. Like, because like you were mentioning with the TV shows, right? Like, he floats in to these different movies and TV shows and sort of touches on, you know, like he's the historical figure that appears. Because like, how can you make a gangster movie set in that time period where like Al Capone doesn't exist, right? Like,
right. So he can't do that. Yeah, yeah. Of course. That's exactly what I was experiencing. So
yeah. So yeah, go. nice to put all the pieces together.
Yeah. All right. Well, are you ready for a quiz?
Yes, I am ready for a quiz.
This quiz is based on just things from the deep dive that were mentioned. You're already at 10 points, so you're off to a good start. So here we go. Question one, baseball. I'm not sure what brand of baseball bat Capone used to beat the three conspirators, but the gold standard of wooden bats are associated with what city? Ironically, that city's Colonels suffered the worst beating in professional baseball history at the hands of the Chicago Colts in 1897, losing 36-7.
I'm pretty sure it's Louisville.
It is Louisville. The Louisville Slugger. That's what we're talking about. Yes. Very nice. Very nice.
I know things about sports.
You did it. You got
not a
sports
a lot of
one.
Things, but I knew that one.
But you knew that one. Very good. Yes. I don't have a lot to add there. You know, I was just like curious. I was like, what is the worst, like the worst loss in baseball history? Because of course, my beloved Rockies spent opening day of this season just a couple days ago losing 16-2 to the Diamondbacks. So I was like, I know that's not the worst loss, but it's pretty bad. I wonder if it's the Rockies who have the record for the worst. They actually don't. Of modern teams, I believe the Orioles have the worst beating from 2007. Anyway, nice. You're at 20 points. Question two, Alcatraz. Robert Stroud was a pimp in the Alaska Territory, who was convicted for murdering a bartender in 1909. After a stint in Puget Sound, he was sent to Leavenworth. There, he developed a particular hobby and published Diseases of Canaries in 1933. He was transferred to Alcatraz in 1942, which solidified what nickname, even though he wasn't allowed to pursue that hobby while there.
Is it Birdman?
It is Birdman.
Yeah.
The Birdman of Alcatraz. Yes. Very nice. I was going to make a reference to the professional basketball player from like 15 years ago who played for the Nuggets, but I didn't think you would get that.
I would not.
Yeah, Robert Stroud, weird guy, like very violent, had altercations with a number of prisoners and also like guards during his time in prison. He wasn't allowed to have birds, though. Like, at Leavenworth, he was allowed to, like, keep birds, and he learned a lot about them, and he published a lot of works and did studies into, like, bird diseases and everything. Once he was transferred to Alcatraz, he wasn't allowed to have birds, though. So he studied, like, law and stuff. Like, intelligent guy, but also, like, you know, clearly, like, criminally insane.
Yeah.
Nice, you're at 30 points. Question three, The Untouchables. The Untouchables is an historically questionable film starring Kevin Costner and Sean Connery. Historically, the term Dalit is a self-applied concept for those called untouchables and others who are outside of what religious cultural system?
The caste system.
Can you be a little more specific?
Like the Indian caste system.
Yeah, yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, the Indian Hindu caste system. Yeah, yeah. For sure, yes. The Untouchables. I know I have mentioned the cartoon show Hysteria before on the podcast from when we were kids, like a history-based cartoon, because Napoleon was a recurring figure on there, and that's how I learned most of what I know about Napoleon. Just kidding, but not really. But I don't remember what they were talking about, but I remember Untouchables coming up and them having like cartoon Elliot Ness standing next to like poor Indian people and someone saying like, you know, no, not those Untouchables, and like shoving Kevin Costner out of the way because they were talking about the caste system or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So I will always have that association in my head. Anyway. Nice. You are at, what, 40 points? This is going amazingly.
Yeah.
Question 4. Pineapple. Like the pineapple primary. A specific recurring atmospheric river, both in the waters immediately northeast of the Hawaiian Islands and extending northeast to any location along the Pacific coast of North America, is known by what two-word name? It can also refer to a sativa-dominant hybrid marijuana strain or a 2008 Judd Apatow film.
Huh. Atmospheric river? Is that the term that you used?
It is. Which okay. is a fun term.
I'm not super up on my marijuana strains.
What?
I know. Shocking. I know.
An atmospheric river is also known as a tropical plume, tropical connection, moisture plume, water vapor surge, or cloud band. If that helps.
Okay. The only thing that's coming to mind that it could be, I'm not sure if this is an atmospheric river or if it's some other meteorological thing, but I don't have a better guess. So I think I'm going to guess El Nino and hope for the best.
It is not El Nino. I'm looking for Pineapple Express.
Okay.
Apparently, if you blend the strain pineapple and something to do with trains, train wreck, you get Pineapple Express. I wouldn't know.
Okay.
I definitely don't do that. But yes, that is a Pineapple Express. El Nino, I think El Nino is more of a weather pattern.
Yeah.
Than like a specific tropical plume. I don't know what the difference is. Yeah. I do know that they're different. That's okay. Just okay. got 40 well, points.
Yeah.
Going into question 5. Scarface was a 1983 remake of a 1932 film starring Al Pacino and directed by Brian De Palma. Give me your best Tony Montana and tell me the most famous 6-word quote from the movie. It's an invitation concerning his weapon.
I mean, I'm not going to give you my best. I don't have a best Tony Montana, but I think the phrase you're looking for is "say hello to my little friend."
Yeah, come on. You didn't want to give it. You didn't want to try. Oh, man, I should have made it worth points. To be like 5 points for the words and 5 points for the impression.
I haven't seen the entire movie of Scarface. I was want to do this, and I turned it off.
That's fair. If you're not in the mood, it can be intense.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, you got it. Good job. Say hello to my little friend. All right. You're at 50 points, and the final is Valentine's Day.
I guess I'll wager all 50. Let's try for those triple digits.
Let's go for it. All right. For 100 points, those gross chalk candy hearts were first produced by what company? It's one of the oldest candy companies in America, tracing its origins to 1847 when Boston pharmacist Oliver Chase became interested in devising a more efficient way to produce apothecary lozenges.
I believe that is the New England Candy Company, also known as Necco.
It is indeed Necco. Well done.
Thank you.
Well done. I'm pretty sure you've talked about Necco in depth before on the podcast.
I'm not sure I know a whole lot.
I know that looking at it, I was like, I remember Emily telling me that. So I know at some point you have at least mentioned
touched on Necco, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not going to add any more, but you find yourself with 100 points.
Woohoo!
Congratulations.
With all the rest of my points.
Yeah. You know, one of these days, we're going to cash those points in for something.
Uh-huh. That's right. I wonder what they're good for.
Well,
I'm picturing like the arcade counter.
Oh, yeah. And we can get like a frisbee or something.
Uh-huh.
Or like a cheap little, you know, airplane glider thing that breaks the moment you drop it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, this was very fun. So thank you, as always. And thank you, listeners, for spending your time with us. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a rating or review if you have a minute to do that. Our Patreon, if you want to check that out, is patreon.com/potentpotables. And if you have friends who like Jeopardy, which I bet you do, you should tell them about our podcast.
You can all find us on Facebook at Potent Potables, on Twitter at Potent Potables 1. Our email address is potentpotablescast@gmail.com, and our website is potentpod.com.
That's right. And we'll be back next week with more of the Jeopardy Invitational Tournament. And until then, may your minds be quick and your buzzers be quicker.